You're listening to The Bridge. I'm David Paul. Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum was in Astoria Tuesday to speak at the Columbia Forum. In the afternoon, she was at Clatsop Retirement Village telling senior citizens how they can guard against mail, telephone, and internet scams. We caught up with her after the presentation for this conversation. Ellen Rosenblum, Oregon Attorney General.
Yes.
Welcome back to Astoria.
It's wonderful to be here. It's a gorgeous day.
Now, just a very brief civics lesson to start off with. Mm-hmm. In a nutshell, what is the role of the Oregon Attorney General?
The Oregon Attorney General is the chief legal officer of the state, which is a pretty awesome sound. What it really means is that I represent all of state government in terms of providing legal advice and counsel to our state agencies, to our boards and our commissions. I also have a role in criminal justice, although the district attorneys have the primary role. We assist all the DAs around the state in their work, and we also have some jurisdiction ourselves to investigate crime. We are involved in child advocacy and protective services work throughout the state to ensure that kids are safe. And I'm here today at the Senior Center to talk about consumer protection, which is a huge part of what the Attorney General's office does. And I haven't even mentioned the role that we play in collecting child support in the state. Half of our 1,300 employees collect child support and provide other services to kids and families to the tune of bringing in $1 million a day in the state.
So half of your employees.
Half of our 1,300 employees. We have 12 child support offices around the state. So if you think about it, we actually really cover a lot of ground, and the Attorney General is essentially the head of the agency, which is called the Oregon Department of Justice.
What is the nature of the relationship between the Attorney General and the district attorneys? Is it kind of collaborative? Is it a more hands-on type of relationship, oversight?
No, not at all. We're all independently elected, you see. Each DA is independently elected in each of the 36 counties, and I'm independently elected statewide. So I do not consider myself to have oversight over the DAs. We collaborate and work together, and actually my role is to try to provide some training, some assistance, some collaboration in areas particularly where they need the help. And that is especially true in some of the more economically impacted rural counties, where we can provide some expertise, provide a couple extra sets of hands for the very difficult work that we do in the state and in the criminal justice and law enforcement arena.
So in a primarily rural county where there may not be the resources to conduct investigations, et cetera.
But we help throughout. We help when we're asked. We can provide some technical assistance. We have some pretty sophisticated technical, analytical abilities when it comes to investigating crime that district attorney's offices may not have or may not have a sufficient amount of. So we can do that. We assisted, for example, down in Southern Oregon last year in a major disruption of an international drug cartel. We're still seeing the fruits of that. I think there have been something like 25 convictions and sentences ranging all the way up to 205 months in prison most recently. So we have a huge role. We also bring actions. For example, the case against the big company Oracle, you may have heard of them.
Yes. Oh,
we
yes.
sue on behalf of the state when we feel the state is owed money, in this case quite a bit of money that we feel is owing to us from a company that didn't do the job they were hired to do. So that's an example of something that we do in our civil enforcement division. We have just a big plate of work, and kind of depends on what's going on at any particular time in any one of the various parts of our state. But we try to keep an eye on the entire state because that's my job.
How many total employees in the Department of Justice?
Around 1,300, as I said, half of whom are in our 12 child support offices. So if you put that group aside, which is a huge group and a really important part of our work, there's some 600 plus employees, approximately half of whom are lawyers, and then the other half support the lawyers in the work that we do. So if you think about it, we're representing state agencies. We need at least 100 lawyers to do that work because we have at least 100 agencies, and including the boards and commissions that we do provide the legal services for. Because we want to make sure that we're giving the best advice that we can to the agencies that essentially serve the people of this state. So if we give them bad advice, then they're not going to be doing a very good job of serving the public. So I consider myself essentially the head of the largest law firm in the state, and we try to provide the best legal services possible.
Now, one of the focuses of the Department of Justice, certainly under your tenure, has been consumer protection and protecting the rights of the vulnerable in society, families, children, the underprivileged. What are some of the programs and the processes that are in place to do that?
Well, first of all, we have one of the people sitting right here, Ellen Clem, who's the director of my Consumer Education and Outreach Program. And Ellen, every day of the week, is going around the state essentially doing programs like what she just did here for the seniors here in Astoria, basically trying to make sure that people are aware of what's out there in terms of the scammers and the fraudsters, to help them to understand how to keep themselves safe and to keep their families safe. So that's a big part of what we do. I also have a civil rights director who does outreach, particularly to more diverse communities where English might not be the first language spoken. And, of course, those groups tend to also be vulnerable to some of the bad guys out there who are going to take advantage of them. We're also looking at student issues and student debt in particular, and trying to find ways to crack down, for example, on for-profit schools that might be taking advantage of our students who go to school online, who are trying to hold down jobs, raise families, go to school, and are being taken advantage of potentially by some of those schools that probably shouldn't be operating.
That's a growing problem, isn't it?
It's a big problem in our country, and my office is involved in a large multi-state investigation of for-profit colleges. They're not all bad, but there are some that are particularly need to be kept an eye on. And I just worry that people, once they're not students any longer, are going to be saddled with the kind of debt that is never going to go away. And it's essentially they're mortgaging their futures and not necessarily getting any bang for their buck in terms of jobs, in terms of really being able to use that education in a way that's going to benefit them and their families going forward. So those are some of the things that we're doing as well. We have lots of different initiatives. I would like to add one other, because it's kind of become a huge area of concern for our whole country, and that's the issue of online consumer privacy. And as a matter of fact, we're involved with the legislature in trying to get some legislation passed that would help protect, I'll give you one really good example, student educational data pertaining to students. So when kids go to school now, they don't just have little notebooks that they write in, they go online, they take tests online. Just about everything happens online, and we have some really excellent companies called ed tech companies that can provide some of this assistance to schools to help, for example, determine whether there are kids who need special attention, special work in a particular area. But at the same time, some of that data can get out to places that it shouldn't. It can be sold, it can be traded, it can be used in ways that were not the intent of the educational institution. So we have a bill that would protect student educational data. It's called OSIPA, the Oregon Student Information Privacy Protection Act. So we're really excited about moving that bill forward and hoping that we'll get a really good response from our legislature. And that's just one of a number of different areas of protecting information that people provide online. We talked about that a little bit today with the seniors. Not too many of them in this group are using computers, but most people today are, who are a little bit younger generation. And so we have to assume that any information that you provide online has some sort of protection in terms of how it will be used, who it's sold to, who it's given to, and we're looking very closely at those kinds of issues.
If somebody believes he or she has been a victim of a scam, what would they do? What recourse would they have? How would they contact the Department of Justice?
Well, we have a little brochure here called the 10 Top Consumer Tips to Protect You and Your Family, and there's lots of phone numbers and email information for you to use to be able to contact the Department of Justice. The basic fraud line, our complaint hotline, is 1-877-877-9392. So that's a really important phone number for people to use. We receive something like 50,000 calls a year on our hotline. And every one of those calls is answered and responded to initially by a volunteer, and then farmed out if need be to enforcement, potentially even to lawyers for lawsuits, but hopefully can be resolved short of that. We also have something called the Scam Alert Network, where you can sign up online at OregonConsumer.gov to be notified of new scams, of frauds, and other consumer threats. And I highly recommend that people sign up for our Scam Alert Network. We just sent one out yesterday, and it has the top 10 consumer complaints for 2014 on it. And we talked with the group today about the number one consumer complaint, which is the IRS imposter calls. And believe it or not, we received over 1,000 complaints.
That's astonishing.
On our hotline, just about that one imposter scam. Second is magazine subscription fraud. It's always pretty high up. This year it's second. Telecommunications involving cellular phones, cable TV, and such. That's third. Motor vehicle sales, always on the list, unfortunately. Lots of issues there with buying cars.
And that's actually going out into a dealership and
going out to a dealership and not necessarily getting treated as you should by the dealership in terms of the pricing and other types of issues, the loans, all the things that are involved in purchasing a vehicle. And then down the list, we have financial services, which is, of course, very broad, health-related services, international money transfers.
That one leapt out at me. Because
right.
of the sheer amount of money involved, more than $1 million, $1.5 million.
Well, you know, a lot of these scammers get people to send money through wire transfers in response to their scams. And so if you think about all the scams that are out there, that's the way the money, that's what's what they encourage people to do, because it's the way to get the money and not, you can't stop payment, you can't really do anything to prevent that money from getting into the hands of the bad guys. And so that's why international money transfers are so dangerous and so high up on the list. Home ownership issues. There's still lots of issues with home mortgages. We're doing a much better job now. We have a loan modification program, a mediation program that my office helped to initiate and get passed at the legislature. So that number's actually down, which is very good, but it's still on the list. Collection agencies. There's always going to be issues with debt collectors. And that's something that we keep a close eye on.
Now, are these sham debt collectors, or are they...
Not necessarily shams, but what they are is they have really high-pressure sales. They're incredibly pushy. They call at times of day that they're not allowed to. They maybe call people at work. They really take advantage of people. Sometimes they demand debts that have been actually discharged in bankruptcy. And, you know, if you actually pay, if you actually were to follow up and think that you had to pay that... Let's say you only paid $50. That would essentially totally negate the discharge in bankruptcy, and you'd be stuck then having to pay that debt, even though you thought initially that it had been...
Oh, really?
It was gone. It's a really sneaky way that bad debt collectors use to get your money. A lot of debts get sold for pennies on the dollar by the first party in interest. And so what that means is that if you're one of these agencies, sort of a third-party debt-collecting agency, you've got very little to lose because you didn't have to pay very much for this piece of paper, and you may not even be able to trace that paper back to the initial transaction. So there's a lot of scamming that goes on there potentially, because it may be that the debt isn't even owed in the first place and that they could never prove it if, for example, they had to prove it in court, but very unlikely that these cases are going to go to court. So you've got some bad debt collectors out there. You've also got some reputable ones. And so I don't mean to, you know, put the broad brush against every company out there, but there definitely are some that shouldn't be in business. And we'll try to shut those down.
Shifting gears a bit, and the big news, of course, out of Salem in the last couple months was last month's resignation of former Governor John Kitzhaber amidst allegations of possible influence peddling, not to put too fine a point on it, by former First Lady Sylvia Hayes. Your office initiated an investigation of the allegations, but that's been put on hold, I understand, at the request of the U.S. Attorney for Oregon.
That's right. We have temporarily deferred our investigation in light of the federal investigation, which is ongoing and actually appears to have been going on for some time before we had initiated ours. It didn't actually go public until after we had announced our investigation, but there is apparently quite a bit of activity. There have been a number of subpoenas issued that certainly have been in the public, in the newspaper. So, yes, we have, for now, deferred. We will be back
He will be back.
At the conclusion of the federal investigation, we have an understanding with the United States Attorney's Office that we will be reviewing their investigative reports and be in a position to determine what state law violations there may be at the conclusion. We don't want to be stepping on their toes while they're doing their investigation.
So there will be evidence shared. And
at the appropriate time, yes. That's my understanding. And I assume that that is what will happen.
And you've been in office now for 2.5 years, as you mentioned. Some credited your election with, how should I term it? I don't know if it's a promise, but your policy said you would not make marijuana prosecution a high priority if you were Attorney General. Now that Oregon voters have voted to legalize recreational marijuana, you seem prescient. Did you have kind of a crystal ball and see where public sentiment was heading?
Really, I was really referring, the issue came up in the context of medical marijuana, which, of course, Oregon has had legalized medical marijuana for about 14, 15 years. And so at the time, I was kind of being challenged on that by my opponent. And I simply said, that's the enforcement of possession of marijuana would not be a high priority for me, given all the other more serious drugs that are out there, heroin, methamphetamine, and all the other things that I wanted to do, the misuse of opiates, the sorts of things that kill people. And so, no, I'd like to say I was prescient in some way, but no, not at all. That wasn't even really my issue during the campaign. And I would say that for those who credit me with that, I would beg to differ, because there were a whole lot of other reasons I think I got elected over my opponent, but certainly that was something that I did say, and I have not cracked down on marijuana possession as Attorney General, although truthfully, mostly that's handled by the local folks anyway.
Well, Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, thanks for taking a few minutes to chat
with us. Sure, my pleasure. I'm looking forward to being here for the rest of the afternoon and speaking to the Columbia Forum tonight.
You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio, KMUN in Astoria, KTCB in Tillamook, live on the web at coastradio.org. In today's weather forecast, mostly sunny skies with highs around 55 degrees, nighttime lows 35 to 40. 10 years ago this month, Seattle and its county, King County, made a bold promise to end homelessness in 10 years. The ranks of the homeless have declined in Washington State and nationally during that time, but in the Seattle area, the number of people sleeping on the streets and in shelters has only gone up. KUOW's John Ryan takes a look back at the 10-year plan to end homelessness.
You can find evidence of Seattle's rising tide of homelessness in lots of places.
So this is 3rd Avenue.
Angie Davis takes me on a tour of SoDo. On weekdays, commuters park along the curbs of this mostly industrial area south of downtown Seattle. And 24/7, so do the tents, recreational vehicles, and cardboard structures of the homeless. Davis heads a group called the SoDo Business Improvement Association.
There's somebody living underneath that box truck right there in the back, sleeping bag and a bunch of stuff pushed underneath there, so we got a little bit of shelter from the weather.
We drive by one stretch of sidewalk where cardboard homes squat between a razor wire fence and a Mercedes-Benz. Down the block, more cardboard homes next to a Cadillac Escalade.
I would not walk down that street by myself.
According to the latest count in January, more than 3,700 people live on the streets of King County. An even bigger number have some temporary roof over their heads in homeless shelters or transitional housing. At the wheel of her Mercedes, Davis says she empathizes with people living on the streets, but she asks,
why is it other big cities don't have the same issue?
More people are without homes in the Seattle area than in other cities our size. Only the New York, Los Angeles, and Las Vegas areas have bigger homeless populations than we do.
My name is Vince Mantalonis. I work at the United Way of King County as their director of ending homelessness.
That's a pretty ambitious job title.
It's a very ambitious job title. Some days it's harder to live up to than others, but that's our aspiration in a community like ours. We shouldn't have thousands of people that are homeless.
Vince Mantalonis was part of a group of government and non-government officials that formed back in 2001. Over the next few years, they came up with King County's 10-year plan to end homelessness. Around the same time that Committee to End Homelessness was getting started, the Bush administration essentially required communities around the country to come up with these kinds of plans if they wanted to keep getting federal dollars to help the homeless. The Bush administration focused on ending chronic homelessness. The long-term homeless are a small but costly fraction of the homeless population. Many communities, including the Seattle area, aimed higher. They came up with 10-year plans to end homelessness altogether. Here's Vince Matalonis.
We're really fortunate. We live in a very compassionate community.
Seattle's liberal voters and politicians don't mind spending money on social problems, and there's a lot of money here. King County has the largest United Way in the country, and the world's wealthiest foundation, the Gates Foundation, puts money toward the homeless in its hometown. All told, roughly $1 billion has gone to help the homeless over the past decade in King County. Nearly 6,000 units of affordable housing have been built. That's more than any city except New York or L.A. Yet the effort is losing ground.
Boy, it would be nice to be able to say there's one or two main reasons why we've not achieved our goal of ending homelessness. Unfortunately, it's so much more complicated than that.
Get to know even a few homeless people, and you'll find out there are many ways to wind up on the streets. One morning at the Connections Shelter in downtown Seattle, I spoke with Aaron McFadder, a man named Michael, who declined to give his last name, Gary Ierley, and Jonathan Morrell.
I worked on that tunnel job down there at the Husky Stadium. I was down there for 5 months, and I was doing really good, and all of a sudden got laid off, and I need some work.
Everybody in here got a different situation in here why they became homeless. In my scenarios, yeah, I just got out of prison. That's why I'm down here.
They need to quit trying to charge $1,300 a month for a 400-square-foot studio.
Yeah, like they're doing in the U District.
I was in a car accident, and after that, I mean, just everything just spiraled out of control. Snapped my neck, so I was unable to work for a while, and I just fell down on bad luck. A few years later, I'm still trying to pick up the pieces, you know? I've been through some real tough times, and I mean, you know what I'm saying? I'm down at the rock bottom right now. I have nothing. And I feel like it's nowhere to go but up from here.
Even though we're all frustrated and beyond frustrated and disappointed with some of the results, including the increased count on the streets, which is devastating, we have accomplished a lot of good work that we have been recognized for.
Dan Brettler has been a leader of the Committee to End Homelessness since it began. He's also the CEO of Car Toys.
Thousands of people have gotten a roof over their head. The problem is there's been a significantly higher inbound flow of people coming into the homeless cycle than we anticipated.
Homeless advocates point to forces far beyond the committee's influence, everything from broken mental health systems to racial disparities. 2/3 of all homeless people in King County are people of color, even though people of color only make up 1/3 of the population. Dan Brettler singles out the recession that hit midway through the 10-year plan, but he says even the booming economy of present-day Seattle is still dumping people on the streets. And this might not be the kind of talk you'd expect to hear from a CEO.
We have a very thriving, healthy, growing GDP economy. We're creating poverty at unprecedented levels at the same time. That's a broken economy fundamentally, so there's something inherently wrong with our economic structure.
Of course, many of the root causes of homelessness aren't limited to King County. So why are things getting worse here when they aren't nationally? One reason, according to Vince Matalonis, the 10-year plan didn't focus enough on root causes, like the lack of affordable housing in this booming metropolis.
Seattle's the fastest growing city in the country last year. So rich, poor, and otherwise, we attract a lot of people here. A lot of people get here and find that they struggle with the cost of living and the cost of housing, and which puts them at risk for homelessness.
Among other things, the 10-year plan focused on providing permanent housing for the homeless rather than shelter beds. But since housing is expensive and slow to build, the county wound up with even more people lacking shelter of any kind.
You know, we have this saying, we can't build our way out of it. We're never going to be able to build enough housing if we don't reduce the number of people becoming homeless.
The Committee to End Homelessness has been working to revise its strategy now that the 10-year plan is ending and local homelessness is worse than ever. Committee members mostly avoid saying anybody did anything wrong or promised too much in the old plan. The language of choice is that they're pivoting to a next chapter. Talk of ending homelessness is being replaced with a less lofty goal, making homelessness rare and brief when it does occur. King County has a long way to go on both those goals. Right now, people typically go without a home for more than 4 months. 3 weeks is the target. The committee's members say a new strategy will enable them to help the homeless more effectively, but they say that tackling root causes of homelessness like inequity can't just be one committee's job. It'll take the whole community. I'm John Ryan reporting.
And that's about all the time we have this morning for The Bridge, a weekly news production of Coast Community Radio. I'm David Paul, inviting you to tune in next Thursday morning for another edition of The Bridge.